Now he spoke a parable to them, pointing out that they must always pray and not lose heart, saying there was a certain judge in a certain city who did not fear God or care about man. Now there was a widow in that city who kept coming to him, saying, "Grant me justice from my opponent." And for a long time he was not willing to do so. But after these things he said to himself, "Even if I do not fear God or care about man, yet because this widow keeps pestering me, I will grant her justice, so that by her infernal coming she will not wear me out." Now the Lord said, "Hear what the unjust judge says. And will not God surely bring about justice for his elect, who cry out to him day and night, though he delays long over them? I tell you that he will bring about justice for them quickly. Only when the Son of Man comes, will he find this faith upon the earth?" I suppose you could imagine a smashed up automobile in a junkyard. And yet, for all the damage, by the insurance company and so on, even for all of that, nevertheless, the radiator is in perfect condition. And if that's what you needed, then you would find that smashed up vehicle very useful, because there's at least one thing that you need and that it has, and you can make use of it. That's sometimes that way with Jesus' characters, like this low-down, slub-glub, self-serving politician who's on the local bench in the parable here. He probably was a Roman municipal appointee or one of Herod's appointees, and so on. But what possible good could he be? What could you salvage from a character like this? Well, he might be an instructor in prayer, perhaps. A particular kind of prayer, as it turns out. But as you notice, this parable is addressed to the disciples and says he spoke to them in verse 1. But if you go back into chapter 17, back to verse 22, Jesus is speaking to the disciples. And so this is something that he's speaking to his own disciples, to his own loyalists, to his own people, you might say. It's a story about prayer's day in court. So what's the teaching of the parable and of the instruction and application that Jesus makes? I don't have some nifty, alliterated, digested outline. We just have to kind of go at it roughly tonight. The first matter I think we need to see is that Jesus assumes that you will likely have trouble with prayer. Verse 1. Now he spoke a parable to them, pointing out that they must always pray and not lose heart. Now this is just a general point. This is just a basic matter, but I just think we ought to snag our pants on this nail as we slide off the roof, as it were. We shouldn't pass it up, even though it's a very general point. It's implied here that they must always pray and not lose heart. There are times, Jesus seems to imply, when prayer's going to be hard, when you'll be tempted to leave off of it. There's a helpful realism here. We don't always pay attention to that sort of thing. Richard Buse, who was followed John Stott at the All Souls Langham Place in London, in one of his books talking about prayer, says that at certain times prayer seems arid and unproductive. He said, "I've noticed with young believers that a typical sticky period occurs 2 years or so after their initial decision to follow Christ. But this is normal. It's easy enough to pray when life with Christ is novel and exciting and eventful. But to persist in prayer when everything is flat, that indicates real progress." And Jesus seems to imply here there are those times when things may be flat and you go into what I call anyway Christianity. It's not because you feel that you need to do something and so on. Not that you have enthusiasm necessarily, but you do it anyway because Jesus tells you to do it. There may be times when you don't have much emotional energy. You don't have much warmth of feeling. You have a creeping conviction, perhaps, of the pointlessness of prayer or something like that. Your motivation has sprung a slow leak. And you practice anyway Christianity because Jesus says so. You remember in Matthew 6, verses 5 and 6 in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus said, when you pray, remember he's talking to his disciples, when you pray, don't be as the hypocrites are, etc. And then he says in the next verse, when you pray, go into your inner room. Do you hear what Jesus said? It's like falling off a log. When you pray, da-da-da. Jesus assumes that his disciples will pray. There is no such thing for Jesus as a prayerless disciple. You do that. Even if you don't feel, you do it anyway. There's a certain doggedness sometimes about the Christian life. I must go on to pray. This I know, for Jesus tells me so. Jesus assumes that you will likely have trouble with prayer. That's a very general point that we just observe in verse 1. Now, secondly, Jesus depicts the situation of his people in this world. This is in verses 2 to 5. Jesus depicts the situation of his people in this world. Now, let's try to work our way through this in the story. You see the situation of the widow in Jesus' story here in verses 2 to 5. Now, this widow may not have been elderly. Sometimes we would think, well, maybe she was in the 60s or 70s and so on. But no, marriages took place a good deal earlier than is customary among us. She could have been a widow in a relatively young age. It could have been in her 40s or something like that. We don't know, but she's a widow. There's no mention here of her specific difficulty, is there? Doesn't say. But you do notice what her request is in verse 3 when she goes to this scurvy judge. She says, grant me justice from my opponent. That's her request. Now, that word, grant me justice, it's the verb form there, either as that verb or the related noun, that basic word occurs 4 times in our text. Here in verse 3, in her words, give me justice from my opponent. Then in verse 5, the judge says, I will grant her justice. Then in verse 7, Jesus is making his application, will not God surely bring about justice for his elect? And then in verse 8, I tell you that he will bring about justice. So 4 times there is that idea of executing or bringing about justice. And this is what she asked for. Grant me justice from my opponent. Now the word means, has the idea of receiving justice, to be vindicated, to have a decision in her favor that secures her rights. Perhaps the idea here, as I say, we don't know the specifics, but perhaps the idea here is, since she is a widow, widows were often taken advantage of by devious people and so on, she may be wanting protection from someone who's trying to filch her property or undercut her living. And finally, this nasty judge gives justice and makes a decision in her favor because of her persistence. No, he calls it pestering. Because of her persistence and because of his disdain for inconvenience. He doesn't have to want to go on taking Excedrin all the time. It gets a little expensive. And so he'd give her what she sought, and he gave her justice. But the heart of the matter is, in this request, to give justice to her, to put things right in her case, to defend her against those who were seeking to wrong her. Now, in this, as I say, Jesus depicts the situation of his people in this world. You notice when he applies this, then he talks about God's elect or God's chosen ones in verse 7. That's not just this widow in the story, but this is the situation somehow for God's elect in this world. That is, this is what God's people at large, not just the widow in the story, but this is what God's people at large need and wait for. They look for vindication and justice from the wrongs committed against Jesus' people. You may not know of any for yourself right now, but this is true throughout the scriptures. This is very much like what you read of in that little hip pocket history John gives us in Revelation chapter 6. You remember the seven seals and so on. You remember what John said that he saw when the fifth seal was open. Revelation 6, verses 9 and following. He said, I saw the souls, or you might say the persons, of those who had been slain for the word of God and the witness they had borne. They cried out with a loud voice, Revelation 6:10, O sovereign Lord, holy and true, how long before you will judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? Then they were given a white robe and told to rest a little longer until the number of their fellow servants and their brothers should be complete who were to be killed as they themselves had been. How long before you will judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? When will you put this right? That's the question. And that's the situation, not just of the widow, but of God's people at large throughout the world in this age. They are a people who suffer wrong, who get stomped on, and who are ignored, and therefore they cry out to God for vengeance and justice. Don't let that word vengeance bug you. It's not viciousness, it's vengeance. And vengeance is a matter of justice. We're not allowed to take vengeance for ourselves, Romans 12:19. But we commit vengeance to God. How do you do that? You cry out for it. You beg the Lord to put things right for his suffering people. That's why in our 21st century soft sentimentality, we need to pay attention to Psalms like Psalm 94, verses 1 to 7, which we would tend to be a little bit wobbly maybe about praying, but we shouldn't be. You remember Psalm 94? Oh, Yahweh, God of vengeance, O God of vengeance, shine forth, rise up, O judge of the earth, repay to the proud what they deserve. Oh, Yahweh, how long shall the wicked exult? They pour out their arrogant words, all the evildoers boast. They crush your people, Yahweh, and afflict your heritage. They kill the widow and the sojourner and murder the fatherless. And they say, Yahweh does not see, the God of Jacob does not perceive. O God of vengeance, shine forth. Rise up, O judge of the earth. Yeah. That's the way God's people pray. And this widow in Jesus' story is just a microcosm. She's a mini sample of the situation of Christ's people in this world. And sometimes that's easier for us to grasp rather than making the point in a broad way. To see individual instances. You see one in, for instance, 1661. There was the drunken parliament, as it was called, under Charles II. And in Scotland, they sentenced the Covenanter James Guthrie to death. He was to be hanged at the cross of Edinburgh. His head was to be struck off and publicly displayed. His estate was to be confiscated. His children declared incapable in future days of holding any office, possession, lands, or goods in the kingdom. And after the deed was done, James Guthrie's headless corpse was placed in a coffin and brought into the aisle of the old kirk, where a number of highly respectable ladies prepared his body for proper burial. There was one gentleman who was present that noticed that some of the ladies dipped their napkins in the blood of the martyr, and he accused them of performing, quote, a piece of popish superstition. One lady spoke up in defense. She said, "We intend not to abuse it to superstition or idolatry, but to hold that bloody napkin up to heaven with our address that the Lord would remember the innocent blood that is spilt. That he would grant justice. That at some point he would see that and avenge it and put things right." It's a basic concern for God's people. And we see this again and again in our own time, in the month of March of this year. In Benue State in Nigeria, 30 people died when thugs arrived on motorcycles and cars in a mainly Christian village. They rammed into the yam market and started shooting indiscriminately. 30 people died. One of the organizations in Nigeria has said that between 2013 and 2016 alone, about 3 to 4 years, Fulani herdsmen killed more than 1,878 men, women, and children in cold blood, and another 750 were seriously wounded. When is God going to avenge that? Is he going to pay attention to that blood that was shed? Or you go to Bihar State in India. Pastor Kumar, in April of this year, had a young boy come to his door and ask him if he could talk to him about a personal matter outside. Pastor went out. He was immediately grabbed and attacked by 15 Hindu extremists. They had attacked with sticks and swords and a spiked metal mace. They left him lying in a pool of his own blood, badly wounded with 2 deep sword cuts and wounds. Just 2 months before, he and his wife had been attacked on their church premises. Is anyone paying attention to that? Or you go to Pakistan, and Christians there were bitterly disappointed when an anti-terrorism court acquitted all of 115 suspects accused of setting fire to Christian homes and in Lahore. It happened about 4 years ago in March of 2013. There was a Muslim mob, about 3,000 of them, that rampaged through the Christian community, destroying 178 homes, 75 shops, and one church. And no one has been brought to justice in that incident. Well, 115 suspects, but they were acquitted. Now, there was a charge of a certain Christian was accused of blasphemy of Muhammad. Whether that was true or not, how do you deal with that? Well, you go to court and you submit evidence and you have a trial. Oh, no, no, no. Instead, you get a mob and 3,000 people and you go wreck and rampage and burn and ruin and destroy in the name of Allah. Is anybody paying attention to that? Will there be justice? Will God put that right somehow? Again and again. You see, this explains what Jesus was saying back in chapter 17, verse 22, when he said to his disciples, "The days are coming when you will desire to see one of the days of the Son of Man, and you will not see it." So you'll be in a situation, you'll want to see one of the days when the Son of Man is reigning in his kingdom, and you won't see it, you'll wish for it, because then things will be right, but you won't yet see it. There is this time when injustice can be rife. There's not a quick fix. In desperate need of justice and crying out for it. And if you say, well, but we're not too much in that kind of situation, that's just because our own situation is not the norm. Jesus depicts the situation of his people in this world. Thirdly, Jesus assures his people of God's intervention and relief, verses 6 through the first part of verse 8. Jesus assures his people of God's intervention and relief. Now, Jesus calls us in verse 6 to hear what the unjust judge says. What did he say? Well, verse 5, I will grant her justice. Jesus seems to point out, as he's beginning to apply the parable, that there's both a contrast and apparently a parallel between the pattern of the unjust judge and the way God operates. Certainly, a contrast in attitude is obvious. God doesn't have to be badgered in the sense of being pestered because he's unwilling. So there's a contrast there in character and so on. But there may be a parallel in the pattern of the way things work. We have to tear this apart. Sorry, there's no easy way to go through it. But a lot depends on how we take this in the last part of verse 7, how we translate it. And you have versions and so on that will translate it various ways. One way that it is sometimes taken, I should tell you, you should be relieved and thank me. One commentator says there are nine views of this problem. Another one says there are 12. I think maybe we'll not go into all of them tonight. We'll cut it a little short here. But there are one of the more feasible ways of taking verse 7 is to translate it at something like this. And will not God surely bring about justice for his elect who cry out to him day and night? Implication being, yes, he will. Then there's another question. Will he delay long over them? Implication, no. Then in verse 8, I tell you, he'll bring about justice for them quickly, apparently in the sense of soon. If that's the way you take it, then it has to be soon in the way God reckons it, not in the way we reckon it. But that's one way, and you'll see basically that's reflected in, say, the English Standard Version and so on. Or there's another way that I tend to think is a bit more preferable, and that is that you take verse 7 as the first part as basically a question, but the second part as a statement or assertion within that question, so that it reads like this: and will not God surely bring about justice for his elect who cry out to him day and night, though he delays long over them? I tend to think that that's a little more preferable than the other way. Not two questions, but rather a question. Will not God bring about justice for his elect? Yes, though he delays long over them. That is, I think Jesus is drawing a parallel between what happened in the parable with the judge delaying giving the widow justice, and there's a sense in which he seems to delay in bringing about justice for his people often. He seems to delay long, and then Jesus answers, that may be true, but I tell you, he'll bring about justice for them quickly, first part of verse 8. Now, what does this mean, bring about justice for them quickly? Some translations might even have the idea of soon. How do you take that? Well, some would tend to take that of time, that he'll do it soon. Others would take it of mainly as of manner. That is, he'll do it quickly when it comes. Now, you may not be deeply disturbed or concerned about that, but this phrase that I've translated quickly, I think should be taken in that way, more of manner, not of time. Not necessarily that it comes soon, but that when it comes quickly, abruptly, suddenly. This phrase is used in the Greek Old Testament, for instance, Deuteronomy 28:63, talks about when Israel is unfaithful to Yahweh, they will be quickly removed from the land. That's the manner in which they'll be removed. Or in Psalm 2, verse 2, probably verse 12 rather, Psalm 2 verse 12, talks about the Messiah, and it says his wrath is suddenly kindled. It doesn't mean soon in time, but it means suddenly in manner, quickly, swiftly, and so on. And I think that's the idea here. If you look back at chapter 17, you notice you have two situations that Jesus says will, in which it will be the days of the Son of Man will be, verse 24. And the first one is in verses 26 to 27. He says, just as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be in the days of the Son of Man. They're eating and drinking and marrying, giving them marriage. They were doing their thing, preoccupied with the stuff that people do, until the day when Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all. Now, that doesn't use this phrase quickly and so on, but it gives the image. It's not that it is soon, but when it comes, it's abrupt, it's quick. They were involved in doing their own things, preoccupied with the affairs of life that people are preoccupied with. But on the day Noah entered the ark, the flood came. Abruptly, quickly, swiftly. Same thing in verses 27 and 28. I mean 28 and 29. Same way in the days of Lot. They were eating, drinking, buying, selling, planning. But on the day when Lot went out of Sodom, fire and sulfur came. Quickly, suddenly. Abruptly. And I think that's the idea here. Not that it will necessarily be soon chronologically. He may delay, God may delay long over bringing his people the final justice they ought to have and vindicating their wrongs and putting things right. But when it comes through the Son of Man's coming, it will be abrupt and quick. I think that's the idea. The thing that you need to hold together is that it is certain, this relief, this vindication that God will bring his people at Jesus' coming, it is certain, but it is not necessarily immediate. And there's a little tension there. Certain, but not immediate, and you have to keep those together. Well, for instance, like maybe you noticed a few years ago, I think it was passed on, it was from Reuters, but it was passed on in World Magazine, that there was a Moroccan soldier named Abderrahim, got it, and his bride Bahia. They were the reluctant holders of the record, perhaps, for the longest engagement, 24 years. The Reuters reported that the couple was married, I think it was late in 2003, after not seeing each other since Abderrahim's 1979 capture by separatist guerrillas. The rebels held him captive until 2003, when they released him along with 300 other prisoners. Then this is what the groom, Abderrahim, said. He said he had a blind confidence. I don't know where he got it, but he had a blind confidence in his intended and was convinced that she would wait for him. Bahia knew that he had been captured but hadn't heard news of him for 6 years. I never thought I had lost my husband, she said. I knew he'd come back one day. I don't know how they knew that, but you get the sense there are the two elements there. There was that certainty. I knew he'd come back. I knew she would wait for me. There was certainty, and yet they certainly knew it was not immediate. It was 24 years. That's a fur time, I would say. Those are the two things here. Yahweh may seem to delay to bring justice for his people in the coming of Jesus. But it is certain, even though he seems to delay. That's what's being said here. And all the more certainty we have of God's vindication and relief of his people at Jesus' coming, because we are not regarded by our God as irritating pests, as the widow was by the judge. But we are his chosen ones, his elect. And note what his chosen ones or his elect do. in verse 7. They cry out to him day and night because there is nowhere else they can go. Jesus assures his people of God's intervention and relief. Now, there's a fourth matter here we should look at. Jesus calls his people to perseverance in faith and prayer. Verse 1 and the last part of verse 8. Jesus calls his people to perseverance in faith and prayer. Now, you see that in verse 1. The whole purpose of the parable in verse 1, pointing out that they must always pray and not lose heart. But remember what kind of prayer particularly this is. This is not prayer for a new job. This is not prayer that your house is going to sell. This is not prayer that your kid is going to get accepted into a certain university. But this is prayer for God to give justice to his weary and beaten down people and to give them the relief they ought to have and not to lose heart over that and not to throw in the towel over it. Jesus says, persevere. Don't let anything stop you from praying in this way. Sometimes perseverance can be pretty rugged. And there was a time in about 1960 when Betty Davis, the actress, and her husband, Gary Merrill, toured the country doing readings of Carl Sandburg poems. This was in, as I said, 1960. And in one town where they performed, there were two elderly sisters who had been Betty Davis fans. Maybe they watched Turner classic movies, or no, not then. But anyway, they were Betty Davis fans for years. And they arrived at the theater in high excitement over the prospect of seeing their favorite star in person. And as the show began and Betty Davis appeared on stage, the women were spellbound. They followed every movement she made. They drank in every word she spoke. But suddenly, one of the women put her hand to her chest, fell back unconscious, and died of a heart attack. As she was being taken out of the theater, her sister refused to go with her. Instead, she stood up and begged the Merrills to continue the performance. And when the show ended, there was a big ovation, and Davis invited the old woman to come up on the stage. "I adored the performance," the woman said as she took her place beside Betty Davis, "and my sister would have too if she hadn't died 2 hours ago." That's perseverance. You don't let anything stop you. You just keep on with your task. Now, that's something of what Jesus is saying. Don't let anything discourage you in this matter of seeking the vindication and the deliverance of God's people who are wronged, and what they will have at the coming of Jesus. Now, Jesus, though, voices his own concern about this matter. You notice in the last of verse 8, he says, "Only when the Son of Man comes will he find this faith upon the earth." I've translated that, "this faith." Literally, it is "the faith." A lot of our English versions will just translate it as faith. When the Son of Man comes, we find faith upon the earth. Faith in general or something like that? No, I don't think so. I think that definite article that's used in the Greek text, when he comes, will he find the faith upon the earth? He's talking about a particular kind of faith. He's talking about, as I translated it here, I think gives a sense, will he find this faith upon the earth? What faith? Well, this faith that keeps crying out to God day and night that he deliver his people and looking for the vindicator to come. Will he find his people still praying like that? Or will he find that they have lost heart? when, and see, what may be reflected in this might be something like Matthew 24, verse 12. That come a time when lawlessness abounds and the love of many will grow cold. And Jesus raises a concern here. When the Son of Man comes, bringing the righting of his people's wrongs, will he find this faith upon the earth? Will he find his people? Doesn't sound like there's a Jesus bandwagon going on at that time. So remember especially the kind of prayer that Jesus is talking about here. The prayer that God will establish righteousness in the earth and put things right for his suffering people. Will Jesus find a people when he comes that is still praying not from a sense of rote, but of sincerity? A people who are still praying, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth." Or will our love have grown cold? So, even rotten, corrupt, godless politicians have their use if they teach us to go on praying. Let us pray. We give thanks to you, our God and Father, that you are both the judge above all judges of the earth, and also the friend of your elect, who cry out to you and who keep us from losing heart. And we thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.